for this afternoon is Dolores Sawyer et al. Versus H. Barrett Middlefort et al. And we call first on Kay Hunt to argue. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nord Hunt, and I represent the defendant petitioner, Dr. Middlefort, and will be presenting the argument this afternoon on behalf of both Dr. Middlefort and defendant petitioner, Ms. Lawstead, who I'll jointly refer to as defendants throughout this argument for ease of reference.
So that you don't wonder what's going on, the Chief Justice will not be sitting or considering this case.
With regard to Mr. and Mrs. Sawyer's claim against the defendants, which is what I would like to address first this afternoon, this does present an issue of first impression in Wisconsin. That is, whether a third party, in this case the adult patient's parents, may maintain a professional negligence claim against the defendants for emotional harm and damage relationships purportedly caused by the adult patient's alleged false memories of abuse. Now, for purposes of argument, and in accord with the standard of review which governs summary judgments, that you have to view the facts most favorable to the non-moving party, defendants must accept that defendants in their treatment of Anitra, the adult patient, that they failed to eradicate her asserted to be false memories of abuse. Defendants also accept for purposes of argument the Court of Appeals' conclusion that where a parent has been wrongfully accused of sexual abuse by his or her child, it is a traumatic ordeal that may indeed cause emotional harm. But the analysis cannot end there. After all, there are many examples in Wisconsin law where the court has held that even though a third party or a party is injured, the claim is not actionable. An example that comes to mind is where a person is defamed by a legislator in the course of the legislative duties. That person does not have an actionable claim, not because the court is unaware of or unconcerned with the harm that the defamed person may incur, but because the court recognizes the countervailing social utility of encouraging the free flow of information with respect to certain access to occasions and persons, even at the risk of causing harm to another person. What the Court of Appeals failed to do is consider the countervailing consequences that flow to the therapist-patient relationship if such claims as the Sawyers are allowed to proceed. I have furnished the court with the cite to the Illinois Supreme Court case, which came down most recently, which recognized that approval of such claims really would be an assault on the citadel. The Illinois Supreme Court concluded that to allow such claims would allow a party to recover against a therapist as well as other counselors would be subject to liability by a non-patient third party who is adversely affected by the personal decisions perceived to be made by the patient in response to counseling.
Counsel, if your argument, if the damages asserted were physical damages, does that just substantially change your argument?
No, Your Honor, because I think in the case of, there is the case which the respondents are relying on as Schuster, where you have a situation where you have a duty to warn of the medication effects. But the problem here is that really concerns, in that case, the aftermath after treatment. It really isn't implicating the treatment decision itself. I recognize that it is a much more difficult decision if there is physical harm, but in all these cases which the courts have considered around the United States, such as in Connecticut, Texas, Illinois, Maine, what you have is what the Sawyers are claiming, which is emotional harm. In looking at these kind of cases, one cannot ignore that often a person in therapy is unstable. What they believe one minute, they may not believe the next. If a therapist is now to be held responsible to third parties to eradicate or to investigate the belief system of the patient in order to avoid third-party liability, A therapist might be forced to deviate from the treatment the therapist would otherwise provide to that patient to the patient's ultimate detriment in order to avoid liability to others. As I've mentioned...
I'm sorry, counsel, it just struck me. You make reference to the Texas case and the Maine case, Illinois case. It's my general recollection that those cases are cases that discuss whether or not there is a duty. That is, they're the Paul's Graf majority cases, and of course Wisconsin is the minority where we say we have a duty to everyone. And is a distinction to be made with regard to that difference in those jurisdictions?
There is absolutely no distinction to be made, because ultimately, whether you're a Paul's Graf majority or minority case, when you're looking at it, you're looking at public policy considerations. And if you look at the cases out of Illinois, Maine, Connecticut, Texas, they're all decided on public policy considerations, which are really identical to what this court must analyze. They do it a little different on the basis of no duty owed versus it's foreseeable harm to everybody, and then on the basis of public policy, decide it's not actionable. But I see no basic distinction between those cases and the situation before the court under Wisconsin law. What those courts have recognized is that actions such as that of the Sawyers exact intolerably high price from the therapist-patient relationship and would be destructive of that relationship. Frankly, if liability is imposed here, any therapist would be a fool to treat anyone who makes claims of sexual abuse. Professional services for those who have been sexually abused may become limited or prohibitively expensive. After all, the defense costs of lawsuits such as this, as well as any indemnity costs, may take the cost of treatment out of the reach of those who need it most. Other courts have voiced their concerns that claims such as the Sawyers are inconsistent with the duty of confidentiality every therapist owes his patient. Effective therapy depends on an atmosphere of confidence and trust, with frank disclosure of facts, emotions, and fears.
Counsel, don't we somewhat alleviate that concern if we write narrow, if we write it simply, solely towards the false memory cases?
No, I don't think that you do, because I cannot see any distinction between a false memory case and other situations. Also, with a false memory situation...
Well, I can. I can see a distinction. That's why I asked the question. Why is there no distinction? It seems to me that if we write it very narrowly, we say that there is a duty here, and that in the area of false memory, where repressed memories are somehow brought out by hypnosis or whatever, that there is an action. And if you can prove negligence, you can recover. Because, I mean, you talk about the damage to the therapist-patient relationship. A false accusation is nuclear in its impact on the people who are falsely accused.
Your Honor, the problem that I see in that is the same argument could be made for someone who is accused of infidelity, which the party perceives to have come out of the counseling relationship. I mean, the emotional harm there would be just, you know, perhaps just as great. And that's why I say that I really see these claims as being an assault on the citadel, because I really don't know how you can stop, limit it to alleged false implantation of memories versus other situations where the third party perceives that they've suffered emotional harm as a result of the patient's engagement in the counseling relationship. So I really don't see that it's easy to draw that line. The other concern the court must have is that, you know, in this case we have the adult patient's parents, but when you're dealing with individuals who are very troubled, you can have claims against others such as brothers, sisters, co-workers, And it would seem to me that if the Sawyer's claim is accepted, then you would be opening it up to all those claims as well.
But why is that? Justice Babbage is saying to write it narrowly, and you're saying, obviously using one of the policy reasons, that there's no logical stopping point. You don't think there's a difference between a cousin and the mother and father, and particularly under the facts of this case, which, regardless of how this, you know, we end up, this was a rather horrendous situation that has brought to the court's attention.
I don't think to that cousin that they would see that kind of difference. That, I mean, if someone is accused of sexual abuse, I mean, it would be difficult to deal with. So I don't really see the difference between the cousin and the parents as far as where the court's going to limit.
Or any stopping point. You say there is.
I see no stopping point, and that's why, I mean, and that's what the courts that I've cited to the court have been very concerned about, because any time someone is perceiving that it is the counseling relationship that has led to these charges or the break in relationship or whatever it is, then the therapist or psychiatrist is sued. And the concern there will be, well, if this is going to happen, then the patient's going to be concerned about the communications and the trust that they put in that therapist, because this stuff might come out. And if a therapist is sued, then we also have the other problem with confidentiality and the waiver of the privilege. Now, if the therapist is, a suit is brought, if the patient waives the privilege, then the patient is subjected to the disclosure of things they may not otherwise want disclosed. If they refuse to waive the privilege, then you're stuck in the situation where the therapist or psychiatrist cannot adequately defend themselves and would have difficulty in that vein, and it would put the patient in a difficult position because of the therapeutic relationship.
Well, counsel, are you saying that in your judgment anyway, there is no line that we can draw, that regardless of how far out the treatment practice is, no matter how discredited the treatment is, we cannot reach the psychiatrist who has performed that treatment?
I don't think that you can reach it on negligence grounds. Other courts have suggested that if it rises to the level of where you have a claim of defamation or intentional infliction of emotional distress, maybe that's where you draw the line. But when you're talking simple negligence, I would say no. Because after all, the patient always has their own claim. So it's not like a therapist or psychiatrist who engages in something that the court's view is inherently harmful does not have the claim. What you're doing is a subjecting liability not only of the patient's claim, but to these third parties.
Let me talk simple negligence. It's a fact situation. A psychiatrist is treating a patient, gives some mind-altering drug, and doesn't warn that patient that the patient shouldn't drive. The patient drives and causes an injury to someone, a third party. Why can't that third party bring an action against the psychiatrist for being negligent in failing to warn or negligent in administering that mind-altering substance when he knows that the patient has to drive home? What's wrong with that cause of action?
Well, I think that basically is what the court recognized in the Schuster case. The problem here is there the social, or in that case, the social utility of warning against the dangers has minimal impact on the therapeutic relationship, because you're not really questioning, as I understand the hypothetical, the giving of the mood-altering drug. What you're questioning is the failure to warn the patient of the effects of the mood-altering drug.
Or, but in my hypothetical, the cause of action was also negligence in administering and knowing that they have to go home.
Okay.
Not just failure to warn.
Okay. But even in that situation, again, this social utility of infringing to that limited extent on the patient-therapist relationship because of the physical harm that could be manifest to others is not that great. And the court was concerned in Schuster that it very narrowly limited that because of the concern with confidentiality of the therapist-patient relationship. Now, in this situation, you're going beyond any kind of aftermath of treatment. You're going directly into the therapeutic relationship. As I understand the argument that's being made now to this court, which is really different than what I saw presented to the circuit court, is that the Sawyers are now asserting that the defendants had a duty to warn Anitra that uncorroborated memories of sexual abuse may impose or harm on third parties. Now, first of all, this wasn't asserted below. The depositions of Dr. Middleford and Losted were taken, and we don't really even have a record because there was no, as I saw it, any questions raised about warning. But let's say, the questions were asked. What is happening there is the parents are imposing their wishes or expectations on the therapeutic relationship of another. To me, this is no different than if a non-client sues an opposing counsel saying, you should have warned your client of the ramifications of bringing this lawsuit to me, and that such a lawsuit obviously would directly intrude directly on the attorney-client relationship. The attorney may not have felt that such a warning was in the best interests of the client. The attorney would be necessarily looking beyond the attorney-client relationship to avoiding liability to himself, which would then thrust into question, whose loyalty, whose interest are you looking out for if you're that client? Are you looking, is the lawyer looking out after his own interests or to avoid liability, or is it really concerned with the attorney-client relationship?
Ms. Hunt, let me interrupt and ask you a couple of questions. Let's assume for a minute that there was professional negligence that occurred here, and obviously that's the allegation. If we don't allow claims such as are being brought by the plaintiffs, how does society control professional negligence in this area? How does society respond to such professional negligence except by allowing claims?
Number one, the client, the patient, always has their own medical malpractice lawsuit. So any, argument as to control is vested there.
Well, isn't that being brought here through the survivorship action?
Correct, that is, in which we have our own issues with regard to that, whether it does survive under these circumstances. But that there is always that cause of action that's available to put in those kind of controls. Also, the medical profession, the psychiatric profession, does their own regulation with ethics, standards of ethics, so those always exist also.
But that's really of little comfort to the person who has been injured. I mean, you talk about the medical society regulated. It'd be like the legal society regulates its own, but I mean, that really doesn't do justice to the professional negligence malpractice situation.
I disagree because it does, impose certain constraints.
Certain standards, but I'm talking about on an individual case basis.
I think the court always does have to be concerned, though, about then the countervailing problems that I've mentioned, with the confidentiality, with the loyalty issue, with what you're opening up in terms of the cost, and all those considerations have gone into the mix to view that the countervailing policies, like in the example I gave of defamation, the public as a whole benefits from allowing these therapeutic relationships to go on, to not interfere in those, to not make the cost prohibitive to those who, seek out those services.
Counsel, I want to follow up on something that Justice Babbage initially touched upon, and that is a situation where there is, I don't know how to define it, but let's say egregious behavior. Let's say, in a hypothetical, and I don't mean in any way to associate it with or with, not with this case, that some therapist is just way out in left field. And I've got a number of legal arguments and questions and issues here, but what happens if there's a therapist that's way out in left field? I think I can sue someone for spilling coffee on me. I can sue someone if their dog bites me. In fact, get treble damages maybe. But if someone who's way out in left field destroys the most important relationship in my life, there's no recourse. Boy, that's bothersome to me. I'm doing that in part as devil's advocate, so respond to that, if you will.
Your Honor, there are, you know, in the situation, for example, of defamation where someone's defamed by a legislator. I mean, that's, you know, could be just devastating. There's no question. But the question is...
He who steals my good name steals nothing. He who steals my child steals everything, to paraphrase.
But there is, I mean, there are deals that people suffer every day that are not actionable. The court's concern, it appears to me, is the fact that there can be therapy and psychiatric treatment that runs so amok that no one can rein it in. But I think that the court cannot forget that the patient themselves, the one that is involved and most intimately involved in the process, who engages the therapist and the psychiatrist, always has a cause of action so as to limit that. What you're really talking about here is really a double kind of recovery, which the court was concerned in the loss of consortium cases of when you have an adult child, and the court said no. You know, we just won't go that far because of the concerns of what it's going to do to, you know, in that case it was the medical profession. So I think those same kind of concerns that exist under Wisconsin law exist here. I mean, the court has been recognized in attorney-client relationships that unless there's fraud, we're not going to allow basically a non-client to sue the attorney. I mean, the same should exist here, that the court should be very, very reluctant to go outside and into the negligence realm with a third party. That's why I say some courts have looked at perhaps like if you have an intentional infliction of emotional distress or defamation, something outside the realm of negligence, that's okay. But to, you know, if simple negligence, the courts around the country, at least, you know, most recently have said no. You know, we're not going to go that far because of all the concerns that I've addressed.
Ms. Hunt, Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution basically talks in terms of the right to a remedy for every wrong. If we are to adopt what you're proposing today and not allow claims such as this, are we not running afoul of Article 1, Section 9?
Absolutely not. For the same reason the court's not running afoul of that when you do not allow, given my example of a legislator who defames someone, there's no remedy there. But what the court has recognized is that in certain situations, the social public policy considerations outweigh the incurring of harm to that individual.
Can you tell us concisely what social public policy concerns you see that we would run afoul of if we were to allow such a claim?
The ones that I've mentioned this afternoon, the confidentiality, the duty of loyalty, the opening up of vast litigation where there's no sensible stopping point.
Why isn't foreseeability the sensible stopping point?
Because as I understand the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, they view that it's foreseeable to anyone who perceives that someone engaged in counseling is, you know, acting on that, such as discontinuing a personal relationship, has sustained, it's foreseeable that that third person is harmed. So there really is no stopping point. And that's why the Illinois Supreme Court most recently saying, you know, you can't really see a difference between these false memory cases and any other kind of case where the counseling relationship is asserted to have opened up a different view of things and may have caused ramifications to third parties. I see that...
If I had a friend, or if I were the victim of defamation by a legislator, I think I would know how to handle it. I would wage war, a war of public opinion. I'd go to newspapers, media, I'd tell the story, etc. If you were representing the Sawyers, what would have been your counsel of what they should have done given the injury they suffered?
Well, it's, one of the things that they could always do is go to the Wisconsin legislature and say, you know, you should protect us by specifically enacting a statute that would give us this cause of action. That's one thing that they can do, just as in the example of the legislator, you know, going after, the one who has defamed them. So that's one example of what they could do. The other things is to, engage in, articles, concern groups with this type of thing. But I just do not see that I could advise them that such a claim, should be actionable.
Is this a situation of suppressed memories brought forth by the experts, or is it a false memories implanted?
It's not a false memory implanted for the reason that the memories of sexual abuse preceded any involvement by these defendants. And what I see it, Your Honor, is either it's a failure to eradicate these memories of sexual abuse, or perhaps, and I don't really see this in the record, but to reinforce the memories of sexual abuse. But the record is undisputed that these memories of sexual abuse preceded the involvement in any of these defendants.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I see on the sheet that William Smoller and Gregory Seibel are both going to argue. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Have you agreed to divide your time?
Well, with the court's permission, it was my intention to argue the question of the Sawyer's opportunity to bring this cause of action and Mr. Seibel to address any others, because it appears to me that we have only so far addressed the claim of Mr. and Mrs. Sawyer. It may be that I will consume the entire time if that's what we're going to address during this time.
You may commence.
Thank you.
Limit by rule should be a half hour.
Sure.
Whichever way you divide it up.
Fair enough. What I would propose to do, Your Honor, would be to defer to Mr. Seibold in the event there are questions about such things as latches or statutes of limitations. As already noted, I am here on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Sawyer, the Sawyer family, who are present along with Attorney Greg Seibold from the law firm of Murphy and Desmond. May it please the Court. I would like to begin, frankly, by responding to Justice Steinmetz's question to the opposing side in this case. We do take issue with the characterization of whether this is or is not a false memory case. It is certainly our position this is a false memory case. The record is undeveloped, is where we are in this case. That is, suit was brought, a deposition was taken, a sworn statement was taken, the motion was brought, and nothing more has occurred.
How can we say undeveloped when, as I understand the facts, in 1985 there was a meeting with the parents, therapists, psychiatrist, psychiatrist assistant, and the deceased. But at that time, Dr. Middleford wasn't even retained as a psychiatrist. It wasn't until, I think, 2 years later, and that what they were discussing was sexual abuse, as I understand the facts. So how can you say it's false memory when those memories were discussed in 1985 prior to Dr. Middleford even being on the case?
I appreciate the question. Please let me clarify. What is undeveloped is we don't yet know the history of what happened with Nancy Sawyer from 83 to 85. What we do know is that there are allegations in 1985. And it would be our view, I think consistent with the professional literature, that suggestion can give rise to false memory from a variety of vehicles, the most common one being hypnosis and suggestive therapy. But it is also possible through such vehicles as The Courage to Heal, a book that is highly suggestive of, if you think that you may have been abused, then you probably were abused, is a line from that book. There are women's shelters in Eau Claire that subscribed to some of these literature and that disseminated it during her early time. So
maybe I'm not making myself clear. My concern is that the doctor wasn't even on this case till at least 2 years after the meeting where the sexual abuse was discovered. So how can you say it's a false memory implanted when it was already there?
I think I can get there, and I hope that I can. The point being that when Nancy presented to therapist Celia Lausted, at that point she had, from what we can tell from the record, some vague feelings about, maybe I was abused, the kind that you find in the book Courage to Heal. Celia Lausted.
Her diary wasn't
from. I'm sorry?
Her diary wasn't really vague, counsel.
There was some reference to abuse by her father. The therapy with Celia Lausted continued for 2 years with some direction by Dr. Bemmer. During that therapy, abuse recollections, not just by father, but by brother, uncle, priest, boyfriend, other priest, developed. Those clearly were not there before. Additionally, the idea of multiple personality disorder, which happens to run consistent in these kinds of cases, also came forth. Further, the memories of satanic ritual abuse, my parents were a member of a satanic cult, came forth. So we're talking about a germ that existed in 83, 84, and 85 that got exponentially expanded. Oh, now as to the... Yes?
I really have to stop you.
Sure.
Because you're going to have to explain these diary notations.
Sure.
Which occurred August 6th of 1983, which you said was sort of vague recollections. Well, counsel, I don't think this is vague at all. At first, nothing much happened except he would explain the functions of my body, and that's why I felt so queer. Then he began to caress me. Eventually, oh God, we ended up having intercourse. What's vague about that?
Mike, it certainly doesn't rise to the memories that are discussed later on, the satanic ritual abuse memories and the array of people who allegedly abused her. So, insofar as the array of memories, it doesn't touch that. But what is troubling and where the record is undeveloped...
But you don't dispute that this occurred before she even went to see Dr. Lausted.
Not completely, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be evasive here, but the reason the record is undeveloped is that Nancy went to the women's shelter in Eau Claire, where Celia Lausted was a participant, and again, we don't have all the facts, whether she is a volunteer, whether she was a paid employee, whether she ran groups for sexually abused. So my point being that there's a period of time there that we don't yet know what went on that caused Nancy to write that. What we know is that this exponential increase occurred during the actual therapy and hypnosis with Dr. Lausted. And back to your question, Justice, the as to Dr. Middlefort, there is no question but that the vast majority of these memories had begun by the time she participated. Our theory as to her and our belief is that as a professional who should be aware of the memory literature, it was her obligation at that point in time to step in and say, by the way, memory is malleable. These memories are continuing to come forth. Memories are being, that we are focused, misfocusing your therapy here, and that her obligation is not to step in, her obligation is to step in and try to stop this process from continuing.
So your cause of action against her is in the way that she chose to approach treatment?
Yes.
Her method of treatment?
Well, her endorsement of a treatment that had already begun, and her continuation of that treatment, yes.
One of the problems, and I need some assistance on this, is the old, where does this stop?
Mm-hmm.
And this response certainly feeds into my concern. I think that it is one of the amicus briefs that suggested, I guess, two areas of concern. One is you're you are asserting that a third party would have a cause of action against the method of treatment chosen by a therapist. So let's say an estranged husband doesn't like the method of treatment that the therapist is giving to his wife that's going through a divorce. Under your arguments, an estranged husband would have a cause of action against the therapist. Is that correct?
Well, what I think was pointed out earlier by some of the questions, and what I hope is clear from our brief, is we believe this is a negligence cause of action. There must be negligence. We are prepared to stand behind the expert testimony that we believe is out there and the literature that's out there that would establish that we've covered memory therapy is negligent in some circumstances. That's the line that we draw. We're not suggesting that anybody harmed by any kind of therapy has a cause of action. This is a negligence cause of action. And so I don't know if that answers the question or if you'd like me to elaborate.
It's your position, because it's your case, you're only saying that the kind of cause of action that can be maintained against a therapist is a cause of action in negligence for maltreatment in repressed memories. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is you must prove negligence. In this case, there's a very specific type of negligence that this court has, or type of therapy that this court has already dealt with in the Doe case, repressed memory type therapy. In that instance, if it is established that it is negligent, then individuals who are harmed by that have the potential to bring a claim, just like any other individual who is harmed out of negligence, citing to the Schuster case. Justice Babich, if I might, I do wish to return to your question just a little bit, because I feel like I've left that somewhat open.
I thought you were maybe overstating the case, counsel.
Well, there are some other facts that are still undeveloped, and I appreciate that. What isn't in the record, and I apologize, I don't know the extent to which I can divert from the record. I don't think this is a factual matter. I think it's a legal question, public policy question. But this court should know there was a prior therapist to Celia Lousted, a woman by the name of Anne Franz Cook.
Is that in the record, counsel?
That is in the record only briefly. And we at this point, as I say, undeveloped, do not yet know whether that therapy began this process. We do know that in the 1988 complaint, in the lawsuit brought by Nancy against the Sawyers, she says that it was the therapy in 1985 that caused these memories. Which brings me back to Justice Steinmetz's question. I continue to believe this is a false memory case. We may not be able to track exactly the way that it first began. What we can do is track very clearly what happens once we have the formal therapy notes of Celia Lousted and Dr. Middleford.
Counsel, this is a very difficult case for all of us.
Sure.
I can't imagine anything more devastating that could occur to me than to be falsely accused of child abuse or abuse of my own child. And so I can well sympathize with somebody who was falsely accused, all of us can. But where I have the problems is in the public policy considerations, particularly the ones as to opening the door to fraudulent claims, et cetera. But the one that most bothers me is the assault, I guess as it was put by your opponent, on the physician-patient relationship. Because on the one hand, I am faced with allowing people who, at least based upon where we are right now, to get their day in court and to recover for some terrible wrong that has been done to them. But on the other hand, by doing that, I'm faced with the potential problem of doing terrible wrong to all future people who go to therapists for assistance. How do I resolve that then?
Well, isn't that the same problem that you face every time that there's a question of a negligence case?
No.
Isn't here's what I'm implying.
I've been on here 16 years and I've not had this tough one.
I would accept that this is a tough case. I don't mean to demean that. But my point being that any time there's a question about whether or not a particular therapy, a particular drug, a particular procedure is appropriate or inappropriate, runs the risk of a doctor having to face a medical decision of what they should or shouldn't do with their patient because there's an assault on the propriety of treatment. In this instance, there's a whole lot of support for this type of treatment is bad. there will be a whole lot of expert opinion saying this type of therapy is bad. We aren't assaulting in any way other than suggesting that when there's negligence, there ought to be a cause of action, that when there's a harm, there ought to be a remedy.
Yeah, but in order to prove it, you're going to have to go behind the screen of the patient, of the physician-patient privilege. You're going to have to penetrate that screen. You're going to have to find out what happened between that therapist and the patient who presumably trusted that therapist, unburdened his or her soul to that therapist, and now you're going to tell that therapist and that person and the patient that's not sacred.
With all due respect, I'm not so sure of that. First of all, I'm not so sure that this case presents that question, and I think that that's an important distinction. But then I will get to the question. Please understand that the therapy conducted by Celia Lousted was conducted by a non-licensed therapist who had no professional degree, whose records are not protected, as I understand the therapist privilege in Wisconsin, by therapist privilege. Now, there certainly is confidentiality.
Wasn't she always working in conjunction with a licensed psychiatrist or psychologist?
Yes. So the psychiatrist's records may well be. I'm not convinced that Celia Lousted's is, as evidenced by a statement in one of her briefs that, my gosh, plaintiffs could have gotten the records simply by requesting them. I don't believe that to be the case because of the professional obligations, but I don't think that privilege attends. But my response to the greater question is this: why do you assume that the privilege must be breached? Is that not my problem, my client's problem? If I can't produce the records or the evidence that establishes that it was within the therapy that the suggestion came forth, I lose my case. I have no cause. If I cannot prove that within the therapy, the therapist acted negligently, my client loses his or her case.
Well, how do you prove that without going behind the door, counsel?
I submit to you that's a question of proof. That's not a question of public policy. In this case, I can tell you how I can prove it, and I assume you know. We're the administrator of the estate. In another case, it may be that I would be able to prove it or not prove it according to what the patient has articulated to the patient's friends, to the patient's family, to what occurs in a confrontation, as happens routinely in these cases, and as happened in this case, where the therapist confronts the patient and says, here's what I've learned. I've learned that you've abused your daughter. Well, how did that happen, therapist? I hypnotized her, and during the hypnosis, we found this and this and this. And by the way, I found out that she has 27 personalities. That evidence may be out there. If it's not sufficient, then my client loses his or her case.
Counsel, one of the things that, just following in the same vein that Justice Babbage has addressed and others, is in this case, and we look at, you know, we know that we're not just writing for this case, we're writing for many, for the whole scheme of things in this area. You have a situation where initially, and Justice Babbage alluded to it, we do have at least an 83. We know that the deceased here, and that's another problem, first brought this is her diary in 83 before she went, as far as we know, to any professional help. And the other thing is that the witness here, I mean the person that we're really talking about, passed away. So you have a situation where in 85 it's now 98, but assuming if it was 96 or 97, there was a suit. First of all, there's discovery, there's a suit, and I know that your other counsel may address this, but it's just that the fact that the person cannot testify, I'm talking about the daughter, and the fact that we have at least the initial diary, what happened in 83, is quite significant, at least in my opinion, as to there were some allegations and difficulties. What you're saying, well, then it was exasperated and it went beyond that initial, and that's what we want to show. And that's my concern with just the position that you're taking as far as a policy, a public policy of this court opening that up. Because once we do, we have these facts, And you're saying, well, then we want to go even further. And that's kind of a concern that I have.
I appreciate that. Let me respond a little bit, again, in the same way as I did to Justice Babbitt. That is, please understand, we were able to take two depositions, or one sworn statement and one deposition, by the time the trial court dismissed this case. This case is not yet ready for me to present all of the facts. I assert to this court that we are aware of the fact that there was a therapist by the name of Anne Franz Cook who saw Nancy prior to Celia Lousted. We simply do not have the facts at this point in time to find out whether it was within the context of that therapy that the memories came forth or whether there was hypnosis.
So you don't even know whether she was seeing someone in 83.
Exactly. That was the point I was attempting to make. But what we do know is as soon as she got into the hands of Celia Lousted, then we know for sure she was being hypnotized, and we know for sure that these memories were being worked on repeatedly.
Counsel, we're all well aware of summary judgment. We are all conceding to you that bad things happened. The question is, despite the bad things happening and despite the negligence, and maybe gross negligence, of the psychiatrist, should she be able to recover, or they be able to recover nevertheless? I mean, you're entitled to every inference.
Yes, I appreciate
that.
And obviously I'm here before you to assert that she ought to be able to recover, that just like there are examples in negligence, in other instances where negligence extends to the non-victim, this is another instance, recovered memory therapy, that gives rise to allegations of sexual abuse by virtue of negligent therapy. I mean, let me be very clear that that's what we are proposing here, is not significantly different from a bystander case where someone comes upon an injured family member and is entitled to recover.
Let's take a bystander case, the Bowen case. You would have to show, as I understand it, three things. The victim's injury must be severe or fatal. Number two, close familial relationship between victim and plaintiff. And number three, plaintiff must have observed an extraordinary event. I think it might be tough for your clients to overcome the factor one and factor three in the bystander case.
Yeah, I agree with that. While I believe that we are entitled to proceed on that, and I believe that this claim does constitute that, I do agree that there are some hurdles as it relates to that. One of the biggest hurdles being, what is the extraordinary event? Is it the accusation or is it the belief?
Should we take the bystander test and apply it in this kind of cause of action?
Well, you could, and I was really using that more as an analogy to say there are times we extend beyond the specific person to other individuals. You could, but the problem here is that it doesn't reach some instances, and I can give you some examples of that. One, for example, if during the course of the therapy, the patient comes to believe that they were sexually abused by the father, goes to the father's home, and shoots him.
Well, let's take out the physical harm. We're just dealing with emotional distress.
Okay.
Because
okay.
In Bowen, we said you could do it just on emotional distress, and that's what the test was. So forget physical harm. Should we take the bystander test where there's a cause of action for emotional distress and apply it in this kind of situation?
By and large, yes. Okay, again, we have to reach the physical instance, and that doesn't. But by and large, yes, and I would propose that the kinds of elements that you need to add, and this is a little different than what I asserted in my brief as we talked about the potential for physical harm, but would be that, one, it is a patient of a therapist who comes to believe that they have been abused by virtue of negligent therapy, and that the patient takes action based on that. All right? Those would be the kinds of additional elements that would allow for a claim beyond the specific injured party. I believe that's an appropriate test. Then we aren't attacking a variety of therapy circumstances or other medical circumstances.
Patient takes action, and what was the other one?
Patient takes action, and the patient comes to believe that they have been abused as a result of the therapy, the therapy being a substantial factor, not necessarily the initiating factor.
Counsel, I another question with respect to the public policy concerns. Let me just preface that by saying a concern also of mine, and I'm sure of all of us, is that legitimate, real claims of child abuse need to be protected as well. And one of the public policy considerations in determining whether or not we should allow negligence is whether or not we are opening up the door to fraudulent claims. Now, it seems to me that if we should allow your cause of action to proceed, we would be more than encouraging, we would be actually almost making it necessary for anybody who is justifiably accused of child abuse to threaten lawsuit as a means of silencing the accuser. Can you respond to that?
Yes. First of all, I mean, anybody can threaten a lawsuit. We all know that. Obviously, there's no dispute about that. But a lawsuit in this instance requires negligence. And the mere fact that somebody reports abuse or discusses abuse is not negligent. In fact, this court has already discussed the immunities that attend to the obligation to report child abuse, and that clearly can't be negligent. We're talking about negligent therapy. And so what this court would be doing is saying, if the therapy is negligent, and within the ambit of that is potentially recovered memory therapy. Recovered memory therapy is of questionable value. It certainly, in some cases, has been testified to as being negligent. But that's a threshold we have to get to. And just because somebody reports sexual abuse doesn't mean that the alleged perpetrator can claim negligence.
Sir,
yes.
Your opposing counsel suggested that what the Sawyer should have done would be to go to the legislature. What's wrong with that? Has any state dealt with this legislatively?
Well, actually, interestingly, there are a couple of legislatures that are right now dealing with the question of whether or not statute of limitations should be extended, as Wisconsin did after the Hammer case, and whether or not certain kinds of therapy whether there's a patient bill of rights as it relates to therapy. An informed consent obligation here. So there are peripheral issues that are being addressed, but certainly not this direct issue. And that's of little comfort to the Sawyers, who for 10 years have endured the knowledge that their daughter believes that they were members of a satanic cult and physically and sexually abusing her on a regular basis. I hardly think that a legislative remedy is going to meet their needs at this point in time.
What happened at the motion for summary judgment? Weren't you allowed to present any affidavits or depositions or anything?
We did present. We presented the affidavits of the Sawyers that denied that they participated in this, and we presented the affidavits that included portions from the depositions of Celia Lausted and Dr. Middleford. But what I'm suggesting is none of the other discovery had even begun by the time that motion was brought, so that we were unable at that point in time to, for example, take the deposition of Anne Franz Cook.
The judge just granted the motion in spite of, did you make a protest that you had more evidence to offer?
Well, in all candor, Mr. Justice, the briefing schedule was such that the court set the motion for summary judgment. I believe we wrote our first round of briefs. The defense wrote their responsive briefs. The court issued its decision even before we were able to give our reply briefs, and we asked the court to please include our reply briefs within the record, even though a decision had already been rendered.
I know the people of Wisconsin expect speedy justice, but
this one moved pretty quickly.
I just want to tell you, you had 5 minutes with that light on. If Mr. Siebel is just straining to get up, you might want to share that short time with him.
I think because we've addressed the third-party claim that I will continue, and there is one area I do wish to comment on.
Are you going to hit the survivor claim?
Excuse me?
Are you going to hit the survivor
claim? I'm not, and if you would like to, I will defer to Mr. Siebel for that. Let me just take one moment to say, while it was discussed that there are other states who have decided that there are third-party cases, are not entitlement to third-party cases in these instances, parents being able to bring. I think the questions from Justice Bradley about Paul's graph is very important. The states that have so far said there is no claim here are either states that subscribe to the majority of Paul's graph or are states that were deciding evaluator cases as in Wisconsin, where we give immunity to evaluators. This court should know that there are a variety of jurisdictions that are right now considering exactly this issue, some of which virtually, well, many of which at their appellate court levels have issued decisions consistent with our appellate court, that is, and the most common one, the most recent one being the Pennsylvania one, in both Althaus and Tooman, that was then a U.S. District Court case. So Vermont, New York, Colorado, and Pennsylvania all seem to be on track of allowing this kind of claim. Let me then defer to Mr. Seipel to address the survivor claim.
Would you state your name, please, then?
Thank you, Justice. My name is Greg Seibold.
Go right ahead.
I guess I would like you to set forth your argument as to why these causes of action against both individuals survive the survivorship statute.
Your Honor, I think the Wisconsin law is clear that as Section 895.01 is interpreted, personal injury actions survive to the estate. Actions for filial relations don't survive. Actions for loss of society and companionship don't survive. But actions for personal injury do survive. This case is nothing more than a personal injury claim in the context of medical or psychotherapeutic malpractice.
That addresses as to the estate. What about as to third parties? Is there any issue?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it is not necessary for the Sawyers to go through the estate to get to the therapists in this case. That is a crucial point that that I think Mr. Smoller and I would like to make, that this is a straightforward medical malpractice case and that it is directly against these therapists because of the duty and the public policy behind recognizing that therapists need to, when they treat their patients, say to them, it is very possible that these memories that you develop in therapy are not true. You should not take action on them. And that raises another point that gets to a defense that was brought up, and that is that somehow these claims are invading the therapeutic relationship. Well, the facts of this case are that the Sawyers, the parents, were hailed into a therapy session where they were confronted. In facts such as this, where the parents are deliberately brought into the therapy situation, it seems disingenuous for the doctor, the therapist, to then say that somehow these parents are invading the therapy relationship.
Counsel, just quickly, I see the red light is on. Just, I wanted to touch on the statute of limitations because it's brought to memory. So you have a 1985 confrontation, then you have a 1988 civil action. Now, certainly under the statute of limitations and under the Claypool case, I'm talking about that a reasonable person would have had notice of the injury to the parents. Certainly that, why wouldn't that fall outside of the statute of limitations when in 1988 there was clear notice that if there was an action, that it should have been brought within, you know, the statutory period?
Well, what happened in 1988, Justice, was that there was a lawsuit filed by Nancy Anitra that said that I developed in therapy memories of abuse. The therapists are not identified, and I think Borrello is clear that the identity of the individual causing the harm is an element, is an essential element of the discovery doctrine.
But you could have found that out with a little bit of investigation who the therapists were, didn't you?
Well, Your Honor, the record in this case is clear that the Sawyers tried to find out. They tried to, in 1985, have contact with the therapists to find out why Nancy had these memories. They tried to have contact with Nancy, and they were rebuffed.
Wasn't Lostead at that 1985 meeting?
Yes, she was, Your Honor.
So they knew. I mean, how can you say they didn't know the therapist goes? They were at a meeting with her in terms of the counselor anyway, one of the defendants.
Sure, and as you recognize, Justice, there were several individuals at that meeting, and there's no evidence in the record that it was explained to the Sawyers who was a participant in that meeting in what way, other than they obviously knew who Nancy was and that Nancy was making these accusations.
Thank you.
I would like to briefly address the survival statute, if I may, because I did not get a chance to do that originally. the Wisconsin legislature adopted the language in 895.01 of, quote, other damage to the person from the Massachusetts statute. If you trace it back, at the time that the Wisconsin legislature adopted that language, the Massachusetts Supreme Court had interpreted that language as being limited to where you have bodily injury or damage of a physical character, and that it did not extend to where you were suffering only as to feelings or emotions. And as I understand the past decisions of this court has in the past followed that interpretation of that language. Following that interpretation of that language, the claims of the estate here would not survive, except perhaps with the limited exception of the claim for medical expenses, as I read and understand what their claims are. With regard to the statute of limitations, it's obviously our position that the Sawyers fully knew at the latest by 1988 of any claim here and should have brought it at that time. The problem that the defendants are facing is the fact that they wait until after Nancy has died to bring this claim. That's why we have also asserted as a grounds for affirmance of the dismissal of the case that of latches, specifically the prejudice that we have in this kind of case, because we're never going to know what happened here. I mean, Nancy is dead. The parents have their version. She never recanted. And we're getting into things that, I mean, we just simply will never know. And it's as the respondents themselves admit, it's difficult for them also. So, I mean, this really does present the classic case of latches as a grounds for dismissal. Briefly, with regard to the discovery in this case, in my review of the record, I see no argument made by...